Welcome to our podcast, A Presence on Your Journey, sponsored by Community Autism Resources. And we're podcasting today from Roads on the Patuxent in Rhode Island with the 17th Annual ASD Symposium. And our guest is Deborah Lipsky.
Yes.
And thank you very, very much. We just heard an excellent presentation in this morning's session.
Well, thank you.
And enjoyed it very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you. It means a lot to me.
And thank you for spending some time with us at a very busy schedule.
Oh, no, my schedule is not so busy today. I'm here for you, so no problem.
So I wonder if we could start with giving the listeners to this podcast kind of a brief background of yourself.
Okay, brief background. That's just too broad. You need to be more specific with an autistic person. We've only got 25 minutes, so. Ask me specific questions. That would go a lot easier.
Okay, then let's do that. I guess I want to start with you're the author of a book.
Two and a half books.
Okay, one is Anxiety and Meltdown. And specific question I had for that is, and I hope this isn't too broad, but if you can kind of give us a sketch of the SCARED.
Okay, the Scared Model. That's actually the first book that I wrote, and I had a co-author, Will Richards, at the time. He's dead now. Was the Scared Model. That was the first book that I wrote that was dealing with a meltdown in real time. So in other words, this book was, it's a short, quick, simple book designed for first responders. First responders being anyone first on the scene, being it firemen, policemen, teachers, babysitters, dads, what to do when the person is escalating, having a meltdown. And it outlines the SCARED model that I came up with. And the SCARED model, basically, the acronym stands for the steps required to de-escalate a meltdown. So, and SCARED, S stands for safe. Safety is the first primary concern in a meltdown. You want to keep yourself safe, and you want to keep the individual who's spiraling safe. You want to keep them, safe from environmental factors, keep them away from things that can cause dangers, like them running into the street, them hurting themselves. C stands for calm, and you have to stay calm. A lot of times, especially the higher functioning kids will scream, "I hate you. I wish you were dead. I want to kill myself," and they're venting. And, the people will react by saying, "How could you say that about me?" Or, and they start escalating because their emotions get in the way. Remember, with calm, it's not about you, it's about them. Stay calm. Lower your voice. Police officers are trained all the time not to get into, a shouting match. A stands for affirmation. Affirm that things are okay, that particularly with meltdowns. Meltdowns are an involuntary reaction to overwhelming stressors. So we don't choose to have a meltdown. It's not like I have a quota that I have to fulfill. So when I'm spiraling out of control, I have done everything I possibly can to calm myself down, and it's not working. And I don't need you saying to me, "Calm down," or "What have you been taught to do in these situations?" or "Grow up." I need you to affirm and say, "Deb, it's okay. I'm here. It's okay. We'll get through it. It's okay." R stands for routine and ritual. When a person is escalating, the best thing for an autistic individual to calm them down is to do something that's familiar and that is routine. So engaging in a harmless routine that helps calm them down as a coping mechanism for self-regulation is something we really recommend that people will do, because whatever it takes to calm them down, because you want to eventually put the control back in the individual's hands and allow them to learn to self-regulate. And by resorting to rituals and routines that are safe and not harmful to others, it will help. And E is, empathy. Look at the situation, empathetically. Remember what it's like for people with autism. We have a lot of issues against us in terms of social concerns. For instance, I look totally normal. On the street, you wouldn't be able to identify me as autistic. And if I were to have a meltdown right now in a store like Walmart, people who don't know that I have autism, because I don't look autistic, would automatically just assume I'm acting like a baby, or I'm having a temper tantrum, and wouldn't understand that, this is something that happens out of my control. It's such a lack of empathy, because we look normal. We don't show that we have a disability, that when we do, our disability comes out in the worst way possible through a meltdown. It's not recognized, and we're punished for it. And then D stands for develop a plan, and this should be done before meltdowns. Every person who experiences meltdowns, whether they're autistic or not, should develop a kind of behavioral plan, what to do when I'm having a meltdown, because it's unfair for me to expect that the whole world is going to know how to handle Deb Lipsky. So I carry with me a sheet, and I give it to doctors or teachers, whatever, of what to do should I escalate into a meltdown. These are the steps that you need to do to calm me down. So develop a plan is very important. That's book number one. It's a short read. It's designed that way. Book two is From Anxiety to Meltdown. And although it was published afterwards, I consider it the prequel. Anxiety to Meltdown is a full-length big book, 200 some odd pages, and it discusses the differences between meltdowns and tantrums, interventions for both, but more importantly, it talks about why anxiety is a core trait of autism and not something that needs to be addressed with medication or as a separate disorder, and it also talks about how we think and how we process the world. It's very invaluable among giving a person insight on what an autistic person is thinking, what goes through their brain. So that's book two. A third book, I didn't write the book, I contributed a chapter. It's called Autism All-Stars, and that book is good because my chapter is about learning social skills from animals and how you can adapt. I never had services growing up, so I didn't have the availability of OTs, PTs, speech therapists, counselors. So I had to learn, from my own experiences what would work for me. So that's good. So those are three published books.
I went on your website, which for our listeners is www.autistic-raccoon.com.
No, it's autisticraccoonlady.com. And you know,
that's right. That's
autistic raccoon, and you can either dash it or not. I have the domain names for all of them because I know people misspell things. So it's autisticraccoonlady.com. Just get there. Or best thing is just Google my name.
Okay.
And automatically the website comes up as the first entry.
Okay. And I read some of your stories.
Okay.
And I was curious in studying raccoons and studying the social behaviors, because you were diagnosed in 2005.
2005, yeah.
Okay. In that whole process of studying raccoons and so on, were there some hunches that you were getting in yourself? Some inclination?
Oh, my gosh. I learned a lot of social skills from handling raccoons. And for, not just my raccoons, but also from handling my farm animals. I basically learned how to adapt to society by watching behavior in animals and then taking that and applying it to humans and making a slight modification. For instance, an example is with horses. I noticed that my horses, I have a whole herd of horses, miniature horses and big horses. I noticed that, when a new horse comes into a herd, there's a greeting process. They'll go over, sniff each other, snort a little bit, and then just kind of move on as a way of saying, hi, I'm here. And I saw that repeatedly. I said, well, this is how an animal greets another animal, how there's an interaction. I learned to apply that with people. Of course, I don't snort at people. I've learned to reach out my hand and shake a hand. It's very similar to a horse's greeting. So I just applied it a little differently and learned skills. And with raccoons, I learned a lot of things because raccoons are very tactile with their hands. And as an autistic person, I'm very tactile. So I can understand they need to touch everything, and I could relate to raccoons a lot better. And it was quite interesting how there's a very complex social structure regarding raccoons and how they interact with another, not with one another, and how they interact with other species at a common feeding ground. Like I have like feeding stations, or even how a raccoon interacts with cats or with skunks, and they try to eat the same food. Like at a, I usually put out cat food for animals and for the wild critters and wild cats, and I see skunks there and raccoons and cats all eating copacetically together in a communal feeding. And I learned then how to actually learn how to, I learned how to eat outdoors. I learned how to, do a lot of things that way just by watching the animal behavior.
But until you went through the process of obtaining a neurological evaluation,
yep.
which you had to pay for yourself.
I did, $1,800.
Until all of that happened,
yep.
when did it occur to you that you may have been, quote, different, unquote, than anybody
else? Oh, I knew I was different from the day, I went to school, and I always felt, I knew there was something wrong with me. I didn't know what, because the problem was I'm extremely intelligent, but yet socially, I just bombed. And communication, I had a lot of meltdowns because I could not understand. I would argue with people over words. It's kind of funny. I have a close friend. Her name is Lynette. And she didn't speak to me initially for a year in the beginning because I had known her just through the fair, agricultural fair. And technically, by the definition, I considered her an acquaintance because we just talked on the phone. We didn't really have dinner, tea, or anything together. I met her at the post office once. And she was introducing me to someone else, and she said, this is Deb, my friend. And I corrected her and said, I'm not your friend, I'm your acquaintance. Now, she never called me back. And I assumed she never called me because she just didn't want anything to do with me. And she assumed I never called her because I wanted nothing to do with her because I considered her an acquaintance and not a friend. And it came down to a miscommunication over the word friend. I mean, people who don't have autism use friend so widely, like the postman is their friend, the police officer is their friend. To me, a friend was very definitive according to a dictionary term. So I started losing, people over word issues, and I would argue words over the precise meaning of words, and that just set me apart. I just felt there's something terribly wrong with me. What is it? So the diagnosis after that, it changed my life for the better because at least I know I wasn't crazy and I wasn't different. I was just unique.
But that happened later in life compared to, because as you pointed out, in the early 90s, there was no name for this.
No.
You also say that autism is not a disorder, a disease, a disability.
It's a cultural difference.
It's a cultural difference. I wonder if you can talk about that a little.
Well, I think, you know, we're approaching autism in the wrong way. Autism is on the rise. And more we're seeing Asperger's, you know, high functioning autism, you know, rising. And what we're looking at is that, you know, we're just wired neurologically a little differently. We still have feelings. We still have all the same responses. It's just that we approach things in a different manner, more logical. So instead of saying that we're wrong, it's like, how would you feel if I were to just go, if I had the magic hand and I were to go to China and pluck somebody out of China right now and haul them out of that culture and pluck them right down here in this podcast and ask them to adapt? They would have such difficulty because they don't speak the language, their culture is different, everything makes no sense. So we wouldn't call them disabled or disordered, we'd say it's culturally different. And I think with autistic individuals, once you get to understand us, we're not disordered, we don't have a disease, we think differently. We process information differently, but we become very successful members of society. We're very happy in our environment. It's only when you try to put us into some place that we don't fit in. Like I gave the example of the tiger. You take the tiger out of his natural environment and you put him in a circus environment. You teach him to run through hoops. I'm sure he can do it, but he's still a tiger at heart. And then when he acts like a tiger one day, people get upset. And they do the same thing with a lot of kids. You know, they pull kids out of the environment that they know and they expect them to be something they're not and force them to, you know, conform to society standards. And then when they have a meltdown or they try to break free from that pattern, everyone panics. So they say you can't change the spots on the leopard.
You have a master's degree in special ed?
No, I have a master's degree in education and counseling.
Okay. I mean, this is happening before.
Yeah.
You had your $1,800 neurologic.
Yeah, you're right.
I can't believe you had to pay for that yourself.
I did. No insurance will pay for that. Yeah.
But this was happening before mm-hmm. your diagnosis.
Yeah.
What was that like for you going through education process and obtaining your master's degree?
Well, the educational process up until that, it was a nightmare. Right through to college was even a nightmare because in high school through grade school, grammar school, you know, high school, it was a nightmare because I just didn't fit into their model of teaching. And I was always in trouble, getting suspended, like I said, thrown out of Catholic high school. So it was too, you know, the structure was off. When I got to college, it was worse. There was no structure, absolutely no structure whatsoever. I mean, the instructor, the professor didn't care if you showed up or not. Nothing was rigid. And I struggled the first year in college, my undergraduate. I almost flunked out. I had a D- average. And I struggled. And then I just finally came to grips with, okay, I'm here to learn. Forget the social convention of staying in class. So I would read the book and take the test on the book, and I would only attend classes that were required in terms of I would allow the maximum numbers of absentees. I would just not go to class mm-hmm. because I couldn't deal with it. In my master's program, it was the same way. It was only worse. It was worse because the classes were longer. It was very difficult because in my master's with counseling, it had to do not so much with theoretical learning and statistics. It had to do with feelings. And that was very, very foreign to me. But I decided to persevere through it because it was a challenge. Because I did it not because I needed to know feelings. I needed to understand how you think. I needed to know what makes a non-autistic person think because they are so illogical. It makes no sense to me. I need to study this. So I looked at it as an anthropological study to get my master's degree.
You have several stories. Actually, you have 23 stories on your website.
Mm. 24 as of last night, but yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh.
I keep adding. The stories on my website are actually on the Autism Society of Maine's newsletter that comes out 4 times a year, quarterly. I write for them. And then I publish those stories also on my website. So if you don't get access to the Autism Society of Maine's newsletter, which is free, you can access them through my website.
I like your writing style. And actually, what I noticed even in listening to you this morning, you don't change a heck of a lot from your stories. It's your personality or your mm-hmm. your style comes out in your writing as well as your presentation this morning.
Yeah.
But you have several stories that I kind of took note of. And one was Sister Franca in New Orleans.
Oh, right? Sister Franca. Oh, yep. And
this was the story about the water bottles.
Oh, Sister Franca. And I love Sister Franca is my closest, dearest friend in the whole wide world. And she's a physical therapist. And she really working hard to understand autism. She does a great job. At that moment, she had a senior moment. Yes, because she lives in New Orleans. And what had happened was is basically, she picked me up at the hotel, and then she was going to drop me. She picked me up at the she picked me up at the airport, dropped me off at the hotel, and she had to go back to work. And she said, "Deb, the heat index is going to be 118 degrees today." She said, "I want you to carry a lot of water with you when you go wandering around the city, so you don't dehydrate." And she said, promise me you'll do that. And I said, no problem, sister, I will do that. So I did. I got a backpack that I wanted around the city of New Orleans, and it was wicked hot. And I bought four honking huge bottles of water, put them in my backpack, because sister said to carry the water. And I'll tell you, the more I walked around town, the heavier them bottles got. It felt like, 100-pound bricks in my back. But I did as I was told. So when Sister France Anne came to pick me up that night, she said, well, Deb, did you do as I asked? Did you carry plenty of water with you today? And I said, yes, sister. And I pulled off my backpack and I pulled out my four bottles of water, full bottles of water. And she just about died. She said, Deb, why didn't you drink them? And I said, sister, because you didn't tell me to. It was that simple of a miscommunication. I didn't know. It wasn't obvious sense to me. I didn't have to deal with a heat index of 118 in northern Maine right next to the Canadian border. We're lucky it gets to 70 in August.
This gets at several points.
Okay.
Now, having heard your presentation this morning, the question I had down here is, why was this a miscommunication? And second of all, now having heard you speak this morning, I wonder if you can talk about the language of literalism, because this might be an example. I guess the miscommunication was the language of literalism.
It is. She told me to do something, and I did. See, people with autism, when they're told to do something, we'll do exactly what we're told, no more, no less. So when you say, say to a child, why don't you go take out the garbage today? That's your chore. And Johnny takes out the garbage. Don't expect him to take it out tomorrow or the next day. He did it once. You didn't tell him to do it every day. So it is, and people say, well, you're playing games. And this is the biggest misconception. People with autism are not playing games. They're not trying to, pull one over you. We do exactly as you ask us to do. No more, no less. So if sister says, carry the bottles of water, I carry them like she asked me to. She did not tell me to drink them. So it is a literalism. It's a literal issue. But you have to, and with autism, that is kind of the cultural difference. You have to know when you're dealing with autism, you have to be very specific. And script it in and say what you want done. Don't assume that we're going to jump to a conclusion and understand that carrying water means to drink it.
And in another one of your stories, that's called the Nurse Nana incident.
Oh, the Nurse Nana. Oh, no. Yeah, the most horrifying of my days.
Well, I had a couple of questions. One was the going up from behind and grabbing.
Oh, yeah.
When the hook collapsed.
Okay,
you
yeah.
You called that the worst possible intervention for a person with autism. So I wonder if you can describe how
exactly.
That's the
worst
possible.
Before that, for all those listeners, I just want to let you know all the stories on my website or in the autism newsletter, all those stories are not made up. They're actually happened to me. And I'm just one of those unfortunate people that these things happen. And the situation, her name wasn't Nurse Nana. She was just a lovely nurse, very comforting nurse, and she treated me so kindly. She didn't look dressed like a nurse. She kind of looked dressed like my Nana would. So I called her Nurse Nana just because I needed a warm fuzzy. And what had ended up happening was I had to have some x-rays done, and I had an asthma attack and no asthma medication, so I had difficulty time breathing. So she was helping me back to the dressing room so I could get out of my gown and get back into my clothes. And I just had this thing about modesty. I just want to say, leave me alone. I can do this by myself. I want to, reclaim some shred of dignity, even though the Johnny I was wearing left very little for dignity. So what ended up happening is I began to feel shaky. And I didn't know. I mean, the coat hooks were huge. They were like 12 inches long. They looked like grab handles. How did I know they were in less than 1/8-inch sheetrock? With no backing behind them. And of course, I'm a strapping gal at 180 pounds. So I grabbed onto them for support, and it looked like I was gonna go down. Well, Nurse Nana spied that. And what she ended up doing, she panicked. She thought I was gonna faint. So she ran up behind me and did the unthinkable. Without warning me she was coming, she put her hands on my waist. I reacted very startled because I didn't expect anyone putting their hands on me. I don't like to be touched. So I pulled back, and when I pulled back, I pulled the coat hooks actually out of the wall with such force, it took pie-sized plates out, and we went, it made a loud kaboom, and we both fell backwards, and I fell on top of Nurse Nana, and it was very, very embarrassing, and it could all have been avoided if Nurse Nana had come up to me and said, Deb, I'm coming up behind you, I'm going to touch your waist, rather than just grabbing me by the waist, because I didn't know who was behind me. It was just an instinctual reaction to react like I did, and I put two big, huge holes in the, they couldn't even take any x-rays for a while, because you could see right into the x-ray room, and they had to block it off. It was so embarrassing, and the powder dust that flew everywhere was even worse. It looked like a bomb went off in there.
So
my most embarrassing day.
This autism intervention, or this intervention of the worst possible autism. Now, how would that differ from? Because I think, you know, other people wouldn't want to be, you know, surprised or grabbed or touched
right.
in a surprising manner. So I wonder if you can help us with how is that different from a person with autism?
I think a normal person just would have startled and said, "Ooh, you scared me."
Mm-hmm.
I reacted violently in the sense of I pulled back, tried to pull away. I was still hanging on to the coat handle. So the force of which I was trying to break free from Nurse Nana's grip was enough that was sent us flying. And the problem is I froze in that position. In other words, Nurse Nana didn't know better to let go of my waist. So when she went down, I went on top of Nurse Nana and I thought I squashed her like a banana. I'm like, oh my God, I just killed Nurse Nana. You know, and I was still holding onto the coat hooks because with autism, I couldn't, I was frozen. I was stuck. I just couldn't react. I just didn't know what to do. And Nurse Nana had to actually clamber up from underneath me between her screams of laughter. She was laughing so hard. I was like, shh, shh, shh. We don't need the whole world to know this.
Yeah.
And she had to help me get back. I couldn't function.
See, that was my next question, is what were you feeling? I mean, she said it was the funniest thing in her 33 or 35 years of nursing that she'd ever had. And my question was, how were you feeling?
I was horrified. I put these two huge dinner plate size holes. There were plaster everywhere. I landed on top of her. My little paper gownie ripped to shreds. So now what was covering me, I looked like a, you know, spread out cloth. And it was like my bare butt cheeks were stuck into her. Like, it was just horrible. It was just nasty. And when she went trotting out, all I could see is white footprints from all the plaster dust, because the two of us looked like we were powdered in flour. And I just wanted to crawl under a rock and die. She was laughing. I didn't think it was funny. It was embarrassing.
Yeah.
I mean, again, it was because it was my autistic. It was just a bad incident. You know, she should know better. Ah. And of course, the worst part of it is I told them I was autistic, but they didn't believe me because I looked normal.
Yeah, now, why is that gap or that inability for people to, you know, to take you at your word? Why does that?
Because it's a stereotype.
A few times. Is there a, I mean, it's a hidden, well, I don't want to say disability because it's a cultural kind of thing, but
yeah.
is there a
difference?
What's the stereotype behind it?
The stereotype is people in general, non-autistic people, if you have a disability or a handicap or a diagnosis of such, you must look the part. If you don't look the part, then obviously you don't have it. And that is wrong, because a lot of people with mental illness don't go around and say, yes, you know, I have multiple personalities, or yes, I have, you know, bipolar. And even they have difficulty, you know, mm-hmm. with explaining that they have a challenge. So, you know, and I can act, and the sad thing with me is I can act completely normal when I'm in my environment. I feel safe and I feel calm. So people will say, well, you're talking to me on this podcast and I don't see any evidence of autism because you look comfortable, you look relaxed. So, you know, where is this autism that I'm supposed to be seeing? How do I know it's a disability? Yeah, you just stick me in Walmart and tell me, you know, turn me around three times and let me get lost and watch me become, you know, autistic in a heartbeat.
Yeah, you mentioned that there is this two conflicts between the extremely intelligent,
mm-hmm.
you know, author of 2.5-3 books.
Yeah, I'm working on my fourth book now.
Well, fourth book now, and mm-hmm. a master's degree.
Television appearances.
International
speaker. Just keep going. The queen of autism. Yeah, I know. I'll share the tiara with Temple. I don't mind.
I wonder if you can just kind of go into those two conflicts of, you know, the social versus the intellect, sort of, I guess.
Well, the disparity is, you know, people with autism were very logical, and many people with autism, particularly with Asperger's, I don't have Asperger's, I have high-functioning autism, there is a difference, are gifted intellectually, or have, you know, not even if they're not gifted in their special area of interest, their special interest, are super smart in that special interest, be it whatever it may be. And people don't understand why they can't generalize, you know, but they don't understand, you know, it might be a technical ability that we have, or ability in a limited area, but we can't, you know, there's a big difference between being smart and interacting with a species that doesn't act logical. People with autism, we tend to think and act and speak very logical. So when we're doing, you know, intellectual things, it works. But when we try to interact with non-autistic people who are very emotional, hard to read, and say things they don't mean and can be very deceptive, it's almost impossible to navigate the social network.
Now, I didn't want to get too personal, but you also mentioned it in your presentation this morning, and there are several examples in your stories online, your husband's reactions to mm-hmm. some of the things. And I'm wondering, what kind of a process was that for your spouse to get used to deal with an autistic spouse?
Well, see, the thing is, it really wasn't much, because I didn't just turn autistic when I was diagnosed. I was autistic the day we got married. I was autistic the day we met. I was autistic the day I was born.
Mm-hmm.
So my husband just had a label for what he already knew. at least with autism, he realized it was autism and not me just being, you know, pig-headed and having it my way all the time.
Okay, so
it didn't change anything between us.
Okay. But your diagnosis was 2005.
Yeah.
And you've been married for 25 years.
Yeah, this September.
So you didn't have the actual diagnosis until 2005. So there's a period of time there where, I guess that's what I'm trying to get at. There's a period of time there, you know, what was happening in terms of, you know, did he sense anything?
Oh, no. To answer that, my husband, you know, he had one of those kind of like stupid moments. My husband said he was attracted to me before we knew I was autistic because he liked a woman of mystery. And with me, things were very unpredictable. I mean, you never knew what was going to come out of my mouth next because I didn't regulate what I said. I just became very blunt. So I gave him a woman of mystery and then some.
Okay. In one of your stories, you mentioned something about you were a firefighter.
Yes, I was a volunteer firefighter for many years in my town in Linnaeus.
Okay.
I was also, you know,
I was
working
at that was a figure of speech? Or
no.
Or if that was something?
No, I was a campus police officer, graduated the police academy. I have been a firefighter and chief medical officer, and I worked the ambulance for 6-7 years as an EMT intermediate.
And what was that like?
Loved it. I loved my time with all three.
Did you experience any conflicts with or any misunderstandings, or are these the kinds of fields that are a little more structured? Or I wonder if you could say a little bit about those.
Well, those were the best jobs I had because it really required very little human interaction in terms of emotions. It was very practical. There was always a script to follow, whether it had to be a firefighter, you know, I didn't interact with people as much as I grabbed the hose and went and had to do what I had to do, put out the fire, you know, and I get along better with guys than I do with women because women tend to be 10 times more emotional. Guys are more logical, right to the point and blunt.
Mm-hmm.
So I relate better with men than I do with women, you know, so that was an easy thing. And whether it was my training on the ambulance or with the police department, you know, we were taught how to react to individuals. It was always a script, you know, you always stayed calm. You didn't let your emotions get in the way and you didn't really chit chat with people. You know, you were trying to problem solve. So it was an ideal situation for me, particularly, you know, and I love that field. I love emergency medicine. I love crises. I do enjoy being in a crisis as long as I'm not the one in crisis because I enjoy problem solving. I'm the one that can get in there when everybody else is falling apart and say, let's do this, this, and this, and this without having an emotional, we're falling apart moment.
Okay, so transitioning from those jobs to an international speaker, which I would think requires a lot more flexibility. It's not as scripted, or do you find ways?
Oh, Lord, it's as scripted can be. I mean, I'm in control of the situation. People don't realize. They say, how could you be that on the stage so free? I'm like, you don't understand. I'm speaking about my special interest, and I'm directing all the questions specifically. I am in complete control. It is so scripted. My presentations, you don't even realize how scripted they are and predictable. I could do my presentations in a coma. I mean, you know, it's that scripted for me.
What about the traveling aspect?
Oh, that's not so scripted. That's really bad. Yeah, that causes me problems.
I think that's
problems.
What I was trying to get at is the traveling aspect.
And is this staying in Rhode Island? Is this for this? People in Rhode Island drive a little bit better. Your rush hour is really terrible, especially in Pawtucket and Providence. I had to go pee, and no one let me off the highway. I thought I was going to pee my pants. Thank you very much. Terrible. Okay, now we're happy. That was my admonition to the people of great. And hey, people from Rhode Island. I used to live in Rhode Island, so I know. You know, I can sympathize with you. I lived in Glendale for a couple of years. My husband's from Woonsocket.
Well, Deborah Lipsky, it was really a pleasure.
Dennis, it was
fun.
To hear
you this morning.
Thank you.
To read your material on your website and
thank you.
To interview you. And I really want to thank you for
anytime, anywhere, Dennis.
Thank you. And just want to remind listeners that music used for A Presence on Your Journey is written by George Winston, and A Presence on Your Journey is a podcast of Community Autism Resources. Our executive director is Barbara Domain. And our technical producer today was Nathan Domain. And you can hear this and any other podcasts of A Presence on Your Journey by going on our website, which is www.community-autism-resources.com. And we're also available on iTunes. And thank you for listening. Until next time.